What did Jesus look like? What did Jesus look like? We probably all have an image in our head, and that image probably comes maybe from some paintings or movies or something else. Well, there are a lot of paintings and drawings and sculptures that try to imagine what he might have looked like. This one, does anyone know this one? Yeah. This one was very popular when I was younger. I had a little wallet-sized picture that I would carry around with me. And, you know, when I look at it today, I think it's probably not very accurate, as Jesus kind of looks like a modern American rather than an ancient Jew. But somehow I always found this image comforting to look at. Sometimes when I was feeling down, I'd look at this picture. Or here's another more contemporary one. This is a very modern attempt to imagine what Jesus might have looked like. And he looks kind of like, kind of a little bit like the guy in The Chosen, right? Well, many famous artists have also tried to capture Jesus' likeness. Here are three attempts. The first one, do anyone know who that's by? It was only lately recognized as a painting by Leonardo da Vinci. How about the middle one? It's Rembrandt. I heard somebody say that. Yeah, and interestingly enough, Rembrandt painted a lot of pictures of Jesus, but they're not really among his well-known work. I actually once got to go to the Art Institute in Detroit and see a whole exhibition of images of Jesus that Rembrandt had painted. And many of them were kind of like that one. And then the third one is a more modern painter from South America whose name I can't pronounce and I'm not going to try, who has kind of a little bit of a cubist edge to his biblical paintings that he does it, and that's his image of Jesus. And then artists from other countries have tried to imagine Jesus as though he were someone from their own land. What have we got here? Well, we've got a black Jesus, an African Jesus. We have a Japanese image of Jesus, a Native American image of Jesus, a South American image of Jesus, and a Chinese one, which is actually, he's having some sort of little egg rolls for the Last Supper, it appears. So who gets it right? Doesn't really matter. Isn't there something wonderful, I think, about the fact that we can all claim Jesus as our own, whoever we are, wherever we're from? And our own imaginations can work with these pictures and the biblical stories we've read to help us create an image of Jesus that brings him close to us. And I think that's really what would be most important to Jesus. However we might see him, if we see him as God's expression of love toward us, I think we're seeing him the right way. And no cookies for you kids today. Sorry. Do we have music?
It was a riveting message. That, you know.
You have to process.
Let's stand and say, this is how God works.
This is my Father's world, and to my listening ears, All nature sings and round me rings the music of the spheres. This is my Father's world. I rest me in the thought of rocks and trees, of skies and seas, His hand the wonders wrought. This is my Father's world. The birds their carols raise, the morning light, the lily white, declare their Maker's praise. This is my Father's world. He shines in all that's fair. In the rustling grass I hear Him pass. He speaks to me everywhere. This is my Father's world. Oh, let me ne'er forget that though the wrong seems oft so strong, God is the ruler yet. This is my Father's world. The battle is not done. Jesus who died shall be satisfied, and earth and heaven be one.
You may be seated.
Okay, well, Larry, I gave you the most profound stuff. The kids always get the best. But here's the rest of it. So, once upon a time, there was a young man who was an atheist, but he loved fairy tales. Well, in March of 1916, this young man was waiting in a railroad station in Britain for an overdue train. He became increasingly impatient, and he kept checking his watch. The station was quiet, almost deserted at that particular hour, and he decided that he needed something to help keep him occupied. Then he noticed that there was a little bookstall which was filled with used books. So he went and rummaged through those to see what he could find. One particular book caught his eye. It was not in pristine condition. In fact, it was a bit soiled and tattered. And the book was by an author whose name he didn't recognize, but its subtitle, A Fairy Romance, intrigued him. After paging through it, he decided to give it a try. After all, it wasn't very expensive, and it could help him pass the time on his journey. Once he began reading, he was hooked. In a letter written to his best friend a few days later, he announced that he had thoroughly enjoyed the book, and that it had provided, in his words, quote, a great literary experience. He counseled his friend to put aside whatever it was that he was reading currently and obtain a copy at once. We've all probably had that experience of being so enthralled by a book that we couldn't resist pressing it upon other people. And that's precisely what happened here. Well, if you haven't guessed already, that young man was C.S. Lewis. And the book he discovered in that railway bookstall was George MacDonald's fantasy novel, Phantasties. Lewis wrote to his friend Arthur Greaves that it was hopeless trying to describe the book, and those of us who've read it, has anybody read it? Those of us who have read it surely understand what he meant. It's this highly imaginative tale filled with strange creatures and magical happenings. It is mystical and mysterious and kind of mythic. And honestly, it is almost impossible to describe. At the time C.S. Lewis discovered the book, he was, as I said, a thoroughgoing atheist. But there was something unique which he found in the George MacDonald fantasy novel that quietly began to affect the way he thought about the ultimate questions of life. Writing about the experience decades later in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, Lewis marked the reading of this book as a real turning point in his life, as an awakening to something that up to that time he had not yet understood. It was, as he wrote, quote, as if I were carried sleeping across the frontier, or as if I had died in the old country and could never remember how I came alive in the new. For in one sense, the new country was exactly like the old. I met there all that had already charmed me in Mallory, Spencer, Morris, and Yeats. But in another sense, all was changed. I did not yet know, and I was long in learning, the name of that new quality, the bright shadow. Well, I know it now. It was holiness. The book began to reorient the way that he understood his life and open him to spiritual possibilities as he glimpsed a world of beauty, holiness, mystery, and innocence within its pages. There was something shining through this fairy tale that appealed to him, an otherworldly light that suffused the story with something alien, yet intensely desirable. It was a kind of window into another realm of existence, and it began to change the way he perceived the world around him and of reality itself. As he later wrote, that night my imagination was, in a certain sense, baptized. The rest of me, not unnaturally, took longer. I had not the faintest notion what I had let myself in for, it by buying Fantasties. I think it's interesting that this significant step on Lewis's journey toward faith was not initiated by a book of theological arguments or a collection of inspiring devotional thoughts or a compelling personal testimony of faith. Instead, it was a strange and mysterious fantasy story that awakened something inside him and caused him to begin to look at the world in a new way. What started Lewis on the road to faith was a story that appealed to and helped reshape his imagination. That same journey is open to each of us. And for many of us, our imagination, baptized and sanctified, has been a guide along the road to spiritual maturity. The power of the imagination is such that it sees the limitations of what we've personally experienced for ourselves or the reality that's right there in front of our eyes. Imagination calls us to see more deeply with the eyes of the heart. It offers us another way of perceiving reality. It provides us with images and word pictures that speak to us in ways our reason never could. As the passages for today's scripture readings were being read, I thought how each one of them had at least one and a couple, several powerful metaphors, word pictures that help take us deeper into who God is. We all know how much of a challenge it is to change somebody's mind through arguments. If you've spent any time on Facebook at all, you know this to be true. And I think this is especially true in the realm of faith. I mean, when's the last time that when you ask somebody, how did you become a Christian, their answer was, well, I lost an argument. Yes, reason plays an important part in the spiritual life, but we also need the fresh vision offered to us by the imagination, by art and literature and music and film and dance. It is often the fresh perspective that these offer us that will lead to real change in our lives. So it was for C.S. Lewis. The change didn't come overnight. In fact, it took another decade before he finally and fully embraced the commitment to Jesus Christ. But something began as a result of that tattered volume purchased in a railway bookshop. Later, after he had given his life to Christ, the imagination that started the journey remained an important element in his writings. Lewis was able to combine reason and imagination and a sense of the holy like no other author I know. He wrote highly creative novels, short stories, poems, children's books, and they're all filled with wondrous and unexpected things, and they're wildly imaginative. Lewis always seemed to find a fresh way to communicate his ideas and passions. For example, when he decided to write about the challenges of overcoming temptation, he didn't pen a series of sermons and meditations. He imagined a correspondence between a senior devil and a junior devil who was just beginning to learn the tricks that could be used to lure human beings into sin. That book, of course, was Screwtape Letters. When he wanted to muse upon the afterlife and judgment, he didn't write a theological treatise on the subject. He imagined a busload of people from hell being given an opportunity to see their lives differently during an excursion to heaven. That, of course, was his profound short novel, The Great Divorce. And when he wanted to show the grief caused to us by our selfishness, he gave us a children's story about Eustace Scrub, who metamorphosed into a dragon and could only be released from his imprisoned state through the vulnerable decision of allowing the Christ figure in the story, Aslan, to painfully undragon him. And we find this story in one of the Narnian Chronicles, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. And when he wanted to meditate on the challenges of believing in things that we cannot see with our physical eyes, and the ways that love can be distorted into possessiveness, he penned his most distinguished, I think, literary effort, Till We Have Faces. In all these books, we see an imagination that soars as it reveals truth about spiritual reality. Lewis once wrote that reason is the organ of truth and imagination is the organ of meaning. Both are crucially important to us, but it's the imagination that helps us to find meaning beyond the mere realm of facts. Just because we have the facts doesn't mean we understand. Imagination helps us to understand more deeply what the facts point toward. It makes sense of our world and our place in it. Human beings, I think, are created in such a way that we respond most fully and with every part of our being to metaphors and stories and images. They bring to life truths that we previously only have intuited. They take us beyond where rational argument and theological doctrines can go. And of course, C.S. Lewis was not the first one to understand this. One of the things that made Jesus such a powerful teacher and so effective was the way he used these same imaginative tools to transform human hearts. Mark 11:9 in the Phillips translation captures, I think, this so beautifully when it says that Christ's teaching, quote, captured the imagination of the people. Jesus was a teacher with a vivid imagination and great creativity. His primary storytelling method, or his primary teaching method, seen in his parables and in his vivid word pictures, was that of a storyteller. He called upon the imagination of those who listened to him in order to offer a glimpse of something larger and more profound than the limited religious concepts that they already held so dear. Jesus didn't preach three-point sermons or offer four spiritual laws. Instead, he surveyed the world around him and related what he saw to people's deepest needs. He used the ordinary objects of life to shape his parables and his word pictures. A bushel basket, a lost coin, straying sheep or a house with a shaky foundation. Jesus knew that the best teachers are those who open their students' eyes, thereby helping people see the truth and see it for themselves. He understood that humans are not only created to be creative, but to respond to creativity. Jesus so much understood the power of imagination. And of course, imagination can be deployed in unhealthy ways. And this can lead to unhealthy results. The scriptures warn us against imagination which is not rooted in moral truth. But when imagination is deployed in the service of truth, it can change people's lives. Imagination is not content with abstract truths which are primarily accessed by our minds. Instead, it puts flesh on ideas so we can feel it, see it, touch it. It brings them to life. It uses poetry, pictures, sounds, and movement to engage our entire being, not only our thoughts, but also our emotions, our intuitions, our memories, and our passions. Imagination helps us see that there's more to our world than meets the eye. It offers us an alternative way of perceiving that which we see in front of us. It sees more deeply. It offers a glimpse of what is beyond our present reality. It presents us with new realms of meaning. As one of Shakespeare's characters observes in Hamlet, there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. Imagination can afford us with a view of reality from many angles. Through imagination, we break through the boundaries of our own limited understanding and our own limited personal experiences, and we're allowed to see more than we've ever seen before. Imagination offers us vicarious experiences that we can embrace as our own and then learn from. Imagination is not an escape from reality, but it allows us actually an entrance into a deeper dimension of reality. To those who were worried that reading fairy tales might harm children because, well, they tell stories that aren't true, well, Lewis had a profound response. Fairy tale arouses a longing in a child, for he knows not what. It stirs and troubles him to his lifelong enrichment. With the dim sense of something beyond his reach, and far from dulling and emptying the actual world, gives it a new dimension of depth. He does not despise real woods, because he has read of enchanted woods. The reading makes all woods, all real woods, a little more enchanted. So, how does imagination help us to live the Christian faith? I'd like to suggest quickly five ways that it enriches our walk with God, and each of these could easily be a sermon in itself, so I can do little more than suggest some things that you might want to ponder. First, imagination offers us a larger view of God. Great writers, poets, artists, and hymn composers remind us that God is too large to fit within our limited doctrinal categories. We need mystery, subtlety, and the indirect approach that imagination supplies if we want our faith to be more than just an assent to a list of theological statements. The weakness of a lot of Christian artistic endeavors, I think, is that they approach truth so directly that the art becomes little more than propaganda and cliche. They just aren't very creative. They aren't very imaginative. Yes, sometimes a very direct approach is appropriate, maybe as in a hymn, a worship song, or in a stained glass window. This kind of art exists for the purpose of delivering a message or celebrating a truth. But the limitation of such art is that mostly just celebrates what we already believe, what we already know. We also need art that helps us see beyond what we presently understand. We need fresh metaphors and word pictures that break through the dullness within our hearts. At its best, art says things that can't very easily be captured in straightforward words. Great imaginative work leaves you with the opportunity to wrestle with the truth rather than just shallowly, well, accepting it or rejecting it. Through the process of wrestling, you're invited to discover layers of meaning and how you might apply those to your own personal life. You become a participant in the work. You contemplate, ponder, mull it over. Such creative expression isn't always looking for an immediate response. Instead, it wants to take up residence in your heart and mind, slowly working toward transforming you. Usually, it is just content with planting a seed that will later come to full fruition. Second, imagination can teach us empathy. Novels and films and songs that feature storytelling offer us the experience of temporarily climbing inside someone else's skin and imagining what it might feel like to live inside their shoes. Our compassion and understanding can be expanded by vicariously experiencing a glimpse into someone else's life. If our own limited group of experiences are all that we have to draw upon, our world is very small indeed. We need the perspective that comes from a bigger picture. Without empathy, we inhabit a very small world of our own making. With empathy, we're enabled to make a bigger difference in the world because we not only have an intellectual grasp of people's needs and struggles, but we feel them. We feel them at the deepest level. Exercising your imagination helps you to think and feel more deeply what the lives of others might be like. It can, if you let it, grow your compassion and expand your emotional resources. Imagination can help you develop more empathy and more compassion. Third, imagination assists us in sharing the gospel with others. Works of the imagination can help people feel their way into faith through helping them to see the world from a new perspective, one they might never have previously considered. Effective art can sneak past all of the intellectual objections people might have and prepare them for that moment of revelation where it all comes together. And I lost my place. It can provide that vicarious moment where the truth breaks through. Perhaps the goal of our creative endeavors as believers should not be anything else other than creating a space for belief and helping people find their way into it. Not attacking their unbelief, but wooing them into the sphere of believing. We can provide a glimpse of how lives might be experienced from inside the Christian worldview rather than merely offering an alternative intellectual posture. And when we get people wrestling with reality, reality will begin to disclose its deeper meanings. Maybe our goal isn't so much to outreason the non-believer as it is to out-narrate them, to tell a bigger and better and more beautiful story about the meaning of existence. Imagination is a wonderful tool for doing just that. In our present culture, many people tend to think of the universe as a giant machine, and nature as merely something we can exploit for our own purposes. But the artist and the Christian are both trying to get people to see that there's something more going on. For the Christian, the universe is less like a book of equations than it is like a grand opera. Fourth, imagination inspires hope. When we ponder the world around us, it can be very easy to be filled with despair. It seems like things will never improve, never get better. But the power of the imagination is that it can help us see behind the curtain, to understand that there's more going on than what we can presently see, that God is at work behind the scenes. Imagination calls us to imagine what a better world might look like. It also calls me to imagine what a better me might look like. Once we can catch a glimpse of something better, something more, we can begin to orient ourselves toward that future instead of just wallowing in the pain of the present. We need something that will give us hope. That's why the biblical prophets did more than just call out the sins of their day. They also offered a God-inspired picture of a better day coming, a world of love and peace and justice. And like the prophets of old, we need present-day creatives to challenge us not to lose hope, but to believe that God has a future for us even beyond what we can imagine. And fifth, imagination reveals the holy in the ordinary. We need to be awakened, and this came through beautifully in one of the hymns we were singing today. That was perfect. We need to be awakened if we're to truly see God. God can be found everywhere in ordinary life, in every nook and cranny of existence. The holy doesn't only exist in sacred spaces or sacred ideas or sacred art. In fact, John Calvin famously locked the doors of the church in Geneva during the weekdays because he didn't want his parishioners thinking they needed to have a special place to come connect with God. They could connect with him anywhere and everywhere. The divine presence can be discovered in the context of this created world and all its beauty. It is hidden in plain sight, but it is available to the vision of those who have eyes to see, those with baptized imaginations. Through an experience of beauty and imagination, we can attune our hearts to that divine presence, and we can help others learn to listen for the knocking of that presence at the doors of their hearts. When explaining her own path to faith, the contemporary novelist Marilyn Robinson wrote this: "I felt God as a presence before I had a name for him, and long before I knew words like faith or belief." Like C.S. Lewis, her imagination was baptized before she took the step into faith. We've all been given the gift of an imagination. And if we use that imagination in a God-honoring way, it can be a pathway to a deeper and more satisfying walk with God and a resource that we can draw upon to let others know about the meaning that we have found in Jesus Christ. We can, like Lewis, allow God to baptize our imaginations. So how do we begin to develop a baptized imagination? I think it begins by making a place for beauty and creativity in your life and stretching your wings to embrace the gifts that come through seeing life in a new way. Here are a few ways we might do that. Read a book. A 2020 study found that 47% of Americans had not read a single book in the previous year. This is a troubling statistic, which I think explains a lot about what's wrong with our culture. So be among those who treasure reading. Visit an art museum. Don't rush. Stop and spend time with a few works that capture your imagination. Go to concerts, symphonies, ballets, and operas. Let your ears and eyes be filled with beauty. See a good film. Not merely one that entertains you, but one that transports you to another place and offers experiences you'll likely never experience in your own life. Then, importantly, find ways to express your own creativity. Mess about with paints. Write a poem. Take beautiful photos, not just selfies. Make a sketch. Compose a song. Learn to play an instrument. Or if all that sounds too hard, simply put on a favorite record and dance like no one's watching. As you learn to appreciate the power of a baptized imagination, you'll add more joy and meaning to your life. And you'll be reminded that there is more to this existence than meets the eye. Thank you.